level, that would really help, because we are expecting that in the future, the money that we get from the university, from the state of Illinois, and from the federal government, we are expecting that that money is going to continue to decline over time. It certainly has over the last couple of years. And given that, the future of this station and the quality of the programming that you get every time you turn the radio on depends on people like you. People who not only value the program, but are willing to support it financially. And every dollar counts. And don't think because you would be making a $40 contribution that somehow that doesn't matter. Well, it does. Everybody's support matters. That's why we'd like to get as many people who listen as supporters supporting the station. And certainly we know that it's a fraction. The people who are supporters, just a fraction of the listeners. And we just like to enlarge that as much as we possibly can. And every dollar really does truly make a difference. So what we'll hope that you will do today, if you can, is call the pledge line. That's 244-9455. It's area code 217, and make a contribution. You also can go to our website if you'd like to do it that way, which is will.uiuc.edu. We have a secure website. You can make your contribution that way. You can call in 244-9455. You can put it on your credit card. If you work for the university, you can do it as a payroll deduction. We've tried to make it just as easy as we possibly can. But the important thing is, the most important thing is that we count you as a supporter. And you can do that. It's really easy. We'll take about 2 minutes to give us the basic information, and then we'll let you get on with your life. And it's very important to the future of the station. 244-9455. That is the number to call. Well, this is Focus 580. Glad you could be with us for this hour of the show. My name's David Inge. And joining us in this hour, our guest, M.R. Montgomery. He is the author of a number of books and is a native of Montana and has authored a book that takes a look at the domestication of cattle, particularly how it is that one breed, that is the Angus, the Black Angus, came to be dominant. His book is titled A Cow's Life, The Surprising History of Cattle and How the Black Angus Came to Be Home on the Range. And the publisher on this book is Walker and Company. Our guest, M.R. Montgomery, is a former writer for the Boston Globe. He has authored some other books, including Jefferson and the Gunmen, Many Rivers to Cross, and The Way of the Trout. And as I mentioned, he is a native of Montana. Had a little experience on a ranch where there were cattle. And is joining us by telephone. Questions, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's for local folks. We do also have that toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. At any point here, you can call in, ask questions. You'll come right here to the show. No one will expect you to pledge. It's nice if you do, but it's not required if you want to call in. Again, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Montgomery, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, you're quite welcome.
I think it's an interesting subject. I think, you know, on this program, we try to talk about new and emerging technologies and look ahead kind of to see where we're going. But at the same time, we like to try to do programs that look back a little bit, talk about where we've come from, or at least how we got to where we are now. And this is one of those that would come into that category. As I think it's arguable, as you do in the book, and I think other people would, that the domestication of the cow was one of those things that headed civilization on the track, you know, human civilization on the track that it's taken. And it's one of the most significant things that happened if you go back into the early history of humankind.
Oh, I think it's becoming clearer. It became clearer while I was in the process of writing the book, in the sense that new research kept appearing. It's astonishing. I had no idea when I began that, for instance, there were cattle in Britain during the late Neolithic period, during the late Stone Age, that is the recent Stone Age. And that's just astonishing. One sort of assumed that they came over around the time that something advanced, like, let's say, barley agriculture or one of those things arrived. No, they were there when the guys were running around making stone arrows and milking cows. It's so, just just amazing.
Has someone been able to put some kind of a number, a date on when cattle were first domesticated?
No. The actual very, very first thing is as confusing with cattle as it is, say, with a domestic dog. It has almost certainly occurred in ancient Mesopotamia or in an adjacent area, that is Iraq, Iran, southern Turkey. But that's just speculation. And there was a simultaneous domestication in the Indian subcontinent with the cattle we know mostly in this country from seeing them in rodeos, those floppy-eared Brahma bulls. Mm-hmm. It's a more tropical, tolerant cow. There's quite a few of them in Texas where they survive the heat down there better than most cows. But let's, roughly speaking, 15,000 years ago, a long time.
And there is, I guess, some thought about, because there are a number of cow-like animals around, there is some thought about what the animal was that was the basis, with the wild animal that then became the domestic cow.
Yeah, the closest thing, again, there's no conclusive proof. There's no intermediate steps, as is always the problem with evolution. There's always little gaps, but it's the beast that was known in Europe as auroch. And that's plural and singular both. Well, plural is aurochsen, but nobody ever says it. German, it's a German-derived word. These were just huge animals, really in weight, three to five times as big as the biggest modern cow, and had a reputation, deserved or not, is, of course, unknown, for being extremely fierce. Mm. And somehow, it's a very mysterious circumstance, somehow this very large, very hostile animal was domesticated, and it's entirely speculative how that happened. It's just mysterious. And it's interesting because the cow is a different species than its ancestor, where, the domesticated horse is the domesticated horse and was found in a state of nature of the right size and shape and attitude to be ridden. The cow was not found in nature ready to be milked.
Yeah. It's interesting. There's a little sketch in here of the auroch, and just for size comparison, there's a human being. And you note in the book that probably the present-day animal that in its conformation is probably closest to what is the auroch is bull that the Spanish use for bull fighting. So here's a little sketch of a matador and a bull that he would fight, and then an auroch that stands taller than the man. I mean, this animal is enormous. Now, when you think, even if that animal had been docile, that would have been some chore. But to this animal, if it was as fierce as people think, that must have been an enormous problem because it was so big and a big, tough animal. How in the world are you going to go about domesticating something like that?
It's as I say, it is mysterious. I would not be surprised if the paleontological record didn't someday turn up a more suitable candidate as ancestor, frankly. But this is the one there is, and it's the generally accepted ancestor. So I'm no scientist, so I go along with that.
So as people have imagined how this possibly could have happened, what are some of the scenarios that people think might be likely to explain how it is that now people, 15,000 years ago, however long it was, took this enormous, tough beast and made it into the cow that could be manageably dealt with by humans?
That's right. You see, that raises a fascinating question because in order to, let's say, perpetuate a happy little domestic auroch, one of the things you have to do is keep the wild aurochs away. That implies fencing and things that are technologically probably not available. There's a couple of nice theories, and there's some evidence that it has happened in the present. Some species of animals that are regarded as aggressive and wary have, in effect, self-tamed themselves. There's a wonderful story out of British Columbia of mountain sheep, which are, you know, the mountain rams with the great curly horns and the bad attitude, who actually began associating with rangers in return for a handful of salt every once in a while, and became very, 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 very docile. They would lie down next to the ranger and put their head on his lap. I mean, this is not your image of the mountain sheep. The other thing that did happen, apparently, is that in places in the Middle East, it seems that aurochs were captured. Their bones are just found everywhere. There's human settlement. Were captured, and they think possibly kept in some kind of pen or pit and held for ritual purposes. No physical evidence of it, but it's so odd that there's always, when you get to one of these cave and hut settlements in the Mideast that are, you know, 6, 10, 15,000 years old, there's always some auroch bones around. Not a huge number, but there's always some, apparently. That's not a published piece of work, but that's people at the Semitic research area at Harvard have speculated on this with me, you know, in conversation. So, And now if you're starting to keep one around for a while or capturing a young one, you know, wonders can be done, I suppose. As I say, it just is still a great fortunate mystery.
Yeah. Well, you're in the book, you explain that one of the reasons that perhaps the Angus has become so widespread and such a successful breed is its adaptability. Going back here to thinking about the fact that the first domesticated cows, probably this happened in Mesopotamia, and they were used to a particular kind of environment, it also kind of gets surprising when you think about how far these animals spread, and that all the way up to Scotland and,
right,
you know, perhaps in more northerly kind of climes,
right,
where you're taking an animal that originally was used to one warm environment, and you're making them into animals that were capable of surviving in,
right,
in much harsher kind of climates.
That's right. Well, natural selection goes on even in unnatural conditions. And if you've domesticated an animal and start, of course, parts of the area where it probably originated are high and cold, as well as warm and desert-like down at the bottom. So, but, you know, you start moving cattle, and some survive and some don't. This happens in the modern day. You can have serious trouble moving range cattle any great distance. They really don't tolerate it very well. That is, you know, north or south. It has to be done gradually. It's in the auroch, if it is the ancestor, was a beast of, you know, Germany and Poland and such cold, wintry places.
Let's talk.
Angus probably pushes the limit of being adaptable.
Uh-huh. Let's talk with the caller here. We have somebody in listening in Urbana. We'll bring them in. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
At the risk of interrupting the flow to modern times, something you said about the historical perspective of domestication makes me want to ask about evidence of cattle worship, cattle magic in places other than Europe and the Middle East. It's often argued that the cave paintings that are so touted from the Stone Ages are magical paintings having something to do with a continual supply of food animals, including large cattle.
Right.
And it struck me that this impulse continues up to the time when the golden calf was part of the religious and philosophical debate of the Bible. Do you worship the creator, or do you worship the immediate creation,
right,
on which you either depend or put your trust and hope? Well, all these philosophical questions, what evidence is there worldwide of religious and magic associated with cattle before farming and other forms of domestication? I'll let you go and listen to the answer.
Well, thanks for the call.
I'm not really acquainted with the Indian subcontinent area of domestication. The cattle that are typically found in most of China are of the Middle Eastern origin. They're not the floppy-eared Indian-type cattle. So you've got a cows, you know, from China to Scotland, and they certainly do appear and were hunted. Their bones are found in very old human assemblages, you know, carved up with stone tools and so forth. And anything you hunt in a hunter gatherer society is very likely to become an object of, if not worship, at least an object of prayer, of hope, and magic. The buffalo and the American bison was, in a sense, a religious icon for the Plains Indians, and it, by analogy, I'm sure that that they were. There are little things you find. There are amulets or small decorative carvings of cattle or cattle head. They're carved on the walls of Babylon, which is, of course, after agriculture, but may have preceded it as well. But, you know, it's a religion before history is highly speculative.
All right, let's talk with someone else. I'm also an Urbana caller here, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. In Nepal and in India, there's a goddess who kills a demon who's in the form of a water buffalo who is rampaging and laying waste to the land, supposedly. Mm. The male gods weren't able to subdue this character, but they had to create a female goddess to do the job.
This sounds familiar.
Yeah, and it's not Durga, and her name will come to me as soon as I hang up. I was hoping there'd be enough delay that my brain would let the name come to the surface.
Well, you know, the water buffalo is a remarkable another domestication from a different animal than cattle as we think of them, and interestingly the animal it is probably domesticated from is something called a gaur, G-A-U-R, which was also enormous. And again, somehow, perhaps not a vicious animal, although it sounds like they had a reputation for that, but a large forest-dwelling animal the size of a rhinoceros, roughly, but taller. And somehow those were domesticated into water buffalo, which are, of course, amenable to being, they're plowed and they're milked both. That's the buffalo mozzarella imported from Italy is a water buffalo that's been milked. So quite an animal, and I'm not surprised there's a goddess associated with it. It would require some kind of, I'm sure it would seem to require some kind of intervention to metaphorically change it from the rampaging beast, or the bad water buffalo, into the helpful water buffalo, and that's one thing religion does is explain these mysteries.
Interestingly, cows are sacred in Nepal because it's officially a Hindu mm-hmm. nation, although there are lots of Buddhists and other religions there. Mm-hmm. But so you don't eat beef. Mm-hmm. However, the king declared that the water buffalo was a member of the deer family, so it is okay to consume buff, they call it buff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But cows wander around and...
As we're used to seeing them in pictures from India, then.
And heaven help you if you hit one.
Uh-huh.
But I'm wondering whether the prohibition against killing cattle, cows, which are described as your mother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you wouldn't kill your mother, so why would you kill a cow?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if that came about to keep people from killing off what could be a source of milk and would therefore provide more nourishment to...
It's a very sensible speculation because, you know, the maintaining a healthy herd of cattle is... which are very adaptable to, they can eat almost anything. And they'll eat dead fish washed up on the shore for the protein in them, and they'll eat bushes and so forth. And sure, keeping cattle as a going proposition and not let's say, slaughtering them in time of famine, but holding on to them until the drought is over is a if religious sentiments have logical explanations, there certainly is a very strong logic for keeping cattle. Obviously, it's gotten out of hand. You know, got more cows than they know what to do with. But
yeah, well, one of the things I noticed when we were living in Kathmandu for 8 months is that there were a lot more female cattle around than there were bulls in the neighborhood, which led me to believe that something was happening to the bulls.
Well, yes, because there's a slight preponderance of females in cattle generally. You know, with human beings, they're usually more boys than girls, probably because boys are always, you know, falling out of trees and breaking their neck, I think. But with cattle, it's just a very slight preponderance of females. So if that's happening, somebody is removing bull calves, you know, from the population.
Well, I would imagine that there are ways around all sorts of things, including that prohibition.
That's right, and there are also I'm not familiar with Nepal, but of course in India there are any number of non-Hindu people who will quietly do this for you. Something like having a Gentile light your stove for you on the Sabbath if you're Jewish, Orthodox Jewish. So,
although a number of people who, even though they may not be practicing Hindus, but cultural Hindus that I have known seem to have a deep aversion to beef.
Oh.
The whole idea of a steak is especially...
Well, sure. There are a lot of Americans that have that same attitude, and because either they've adopted the vegetarian attitude or one of the subspecies of that. And
I think it's more akin to our prohibition, our revulsion at eating dog or horse. We just would not think of doing it. It's a cultural thing rather than a logical.
Exactly. Yeah. And particularly, of course, it's so clear that eating dog is a cultural thing. I mean, Lewis and Clark ate a lot of dog going west because that's all they could buy for food from some of the Indians who kept them around just for that. And of course, horse meat's in Belgium in particular, and in parts of France, there are horses raised for meat, not just, you know, like this country where they do put them up for dog meat.
I'm trying to picture a meat horse, like a beef cow. Yeah. You know.
Well, they'd be gelded if male, and be. They wouldn't look much different than any other horse. They might just be a little chubbier because they're being fattened up for the slaughter. But they're not breeds. You know, there are no breeds of edible horse. But they'll just take excess stock and fatten it up and slaughter it at a young and tender age.
I need to jump in here. I appreciate that.
Sure.
The caller's comments, and if other people who are interested in calling in, they can certainly do that, and we will talk some more with our guest, M.R. Montgomery, author of the book A Cow's Life. We do want to pause here for just a moment and remind people that it's important for them to support this radio station financially with their contributions. We're doing this week one of the things we do periodically throughout the year, and that's we sit down here in front of the microphones and do something other than the regular programming. We remind people that your financial contributions are an important source of the funds it takes to run the station, and that we particularly, when we do this, we're particularly looking for people who have not supported the station in the past. New people who would be new to this organization we call the Friends of WILL. We want to remind you that we have some volunteers who are waiting to take the call, and that it will take a minute or two, and that it's very important to the future of this station. 244-9455 is the number to call. Standing by in a studio, actually, that we have converted into this place that we call Pledge Central, is our news director, AM 580 News Director Tom Rogers.
Morning, David.
Hi, Tom.
And we are approaching about 100 new friends at WILL. We'd love to hear from 300 by the end of the week, but we're about at 100. We'd love to hear from you right now. If you haven't gone to the phone before and said, you know, the thought-provoking programming that you hear on Focus 580 and throughout the rest of the day on AM 580 is worth your financial support. Call us up at 217-244-9455, just like that one person is doing now, and have our three volunteers at the moment, Mary Peters or Beth Stafford or Alan Steinberg, take your call. As David said, it'll only take a couple of minutes. And join people like Lisa Chasen, who lives in Urbana, and Marianne Feinberg of Urbana, Dale Elliott out in Lovington. Thanks for joining WILL. Gary Grumman, a new member from West Union, Sylvia Sauer of Urbana, Brian Nodal of Fillmore. All of these people say that you know, the programming they get every day on AM 580 is important enough to keep supporting through their financial support. Your financial contributions make up more than half of our operating budget. It's not like the old days where we relied overwhelmingly on government, state, or university support. It is you that makes the difference for AM 580 right now. Now, as an incentive, if you are a new friend of WILL, if you join for the first time or are coming back after a while, we have this thing that we like to call on Wednesday, Wacky Wednesday, and because of that, one of our underwriters, World Harvest Foods, is generously providing a $10 gift certificate for everybody who calls in and becomes a new friend of WILL. So there's incentive enough to join the friends of WILL, 217-244-9455.
And if the programming isn't enough, and friends, don't you think it ought to be?
It should be.
We have that, and it will go out to you with our thanks. But we think that we know that people are going to support the station because of the value of the programs.
Exactly.
And if we explain, I don't think it takes too much explanation to say, now, look, folks, you're now the single biggest source of the money that it takes to run the station. Yes, we do get some money from the state, and we do get money from the federal government, but that's shrinking, and it has shrunk precipitously over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And there's just no way that we can continue to maintain the level of programming. And, you know, we've cut everything we could possibly think about.
And yet we're talking about new ideas, new innovations, like we had talked with Jack Brighton, our webcasting director, about in the last half hour, things that we're dreaming up to try to bring our service to more people at better and more convenient times, such as the stuff that we offer on our website. That's the innovation that you expect from public radio, and you know, funding shortages or not, we want to keep that innovation going. This is how you help that innovation, by calling up with your financial support to 217-244-9455.
All right. Thank you very much, Tom. We'll talk with you again at the end of the program. We want to continue here our conversation with the guest for this hour, M.R. Montgomery. He is a former writer for the Boston Globe. He has authored a number of books, and his most recent that came out actually last fall is this book we're talking about here, A Cow's Life, The Surprising History of Cattle and How the Black Angus Came to Be Home on the Range. And the publisher on this book is Walker & Company, and it explores some of the history of the domestication of cattle, how that came about, something about how important that has been to human civilization, and then also the emergence of this particular breed, the Black Angus, and why it is that it has become so dominant, such a dominant animal. Number here, if you'd like to call in, and you certainly are welcome to do that, call, ask questions, 333-9455. Now, that's the one for people who live in Champaign-Urbana, here where we are. We do also have a toll-free line. And anywhere you could be listening around Illinois, Indiana, as a matter of fact, if you were listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may also use that toll-free number, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, we've got some callers here. Mr. Montgomery, we'll go back to the phones and talk next with someone here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Thanks again.
Sure.
At the risk of whiplash, I'd like to shift from the very earliest question, the unknowns of how it began, to the probably unknowns of how it will continue. We now have what amounts to factory farming of chickens, which were once a rare delicacy because they were prized for eggs. We are working toward factory farming of pork, which were once let loose because they did eat anything. Do you have any sense of whether we're going to be having factory farming of beef cattle and whether that would require, say, processing of a smaller strain or even a smaller species that would be more amenable to lifetime confinement? It's an extreme question, but I'd appreciate your speculation. Thank you.
Well, I'm happy to speculate on that. I think the answer is not really, no. And one of the reasons is that the animals that lend themselves to factory farming, and I'd say we've achieved that with swine, are animals that are extremely prolific in the number of offspring they produce and whose growth is very brief. That is, you know, the average chicken that you're buying in the supermarket is probably 16 weeks old. The average pork chop is around a year old. And cattle are really not up to eating size until they're well over a year, and the standard go to feedlots around 18 months. So, and twins are not unknown, but there are no triplets in the cow world, and there's certainly no, you know, litters or flocks, which you have with the animals that are amenable to the factory farm. So I think that their slower rate of growth and their lower rate of reproduction just mitigates against the factory. There is, of course, a definite factory aspect to the feedlot industry, but that's a brief part of the animal's lifespan. So I think the answer is no. The other thing, of course, is about the smaller animals is there was a fad started in the 1930s, and older farmers and consumers may remember that there was a period of time when cuts of beef were really quite small, and that's because the animals going to the packing plants were about half the size of a normal cow. They've been bred deliberately to be small for a variety of reasons. Angus, when my cousin started growing them, if they were sold as purebred Angus, were quite small and were actually marketed nationally as baby beef. You know? Well, quite small, meaning they weighed about 900 pounds instead of 1,800 pounds. Hmm. So, yeah, I think that their need for room probably could be bred out of them, but I can't see how, given just the animal's basic physiology, they'd really adapt themselves very well to confinement from birth to slaughter, which is what we're talking about with factory farming.
Okay, let's talk with a caller in Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Two questions. One more speculative. When you first came on, the first thing came to my mind were those paintings for Minos, where they have the bull jumpers or, mm-hmm. or those acrobat types.
Mm-hmm.
And as I remember, I was most of the time I've been trying to side thinking what the time frame was that in relationship to the time frame you're talking about with the breeding.
Mm-hmm.
But those were huge. If we assume that the perspective is correct and all that,
mm-hmm.
those were huge animals.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember as a youngster when I first saw them on a stamp
mm-hmm.
From Greece, you know, I thought, my God, you know, they're stretching these animals out, you know. Then when I got more, you know, older and I come across the different kinds of painting, you know, especially since the 19th century, I thought, well, maybe, you know, that's just an aesthetic thing that they chose to do, but I really don't know where that stands. But I was wondering, in your researching, if you come across any, you know, relevance of those bulls on the pieces or whatever. Second question is, I remember the baby beef myself, as far as that goes. What is it about Angus that makes it the prized, you know, thing at the restaurants and things like that over other types of cattle we have in this country?
Sure.
Was it meant to go that way? Is this the one that we can most easily, you know, resolve genetically fastest, or is there something inherent in the meat, you know, fat versus whatever? Is it the flavor that people say is the better of the two? Thanks a lot.
All right.
Sure. The reputation of the Angus is as an edible is that it is probably more flavorful, although some other breeders would deny that. It's also acknowledged to be a little bit tougher unless it's really well aged. So the flavor business is, as I say, speculative. But the other thing is that the animal is an extremely manageable domestic animal. Its tendencies are to good behavior, including the bulls. They are fairly easy calvers. In standard Angus that haven't been mucked around with much, assisted births are fairly rare, not uncommon. I say they are uncommon; they're not rare. And so, the animal has these economic advantages. It's easily handled, and it's got a reputation for good flavor, and it's been marketed very well. But it is also the dominant animal in Europe for many years, and now losing some ground for reasons that really get complicated. But it's a mixture of those things, good flavor and good behavior.
Hmm. What I don't know what you could say about the bull jumping in the ancient Minoans, but I perhaps people have seen those pictures and have thought, well, is that, what about the relationship between the size of the animal, the size of the person? But if indeed these animals were auroch size, pretty much that the scale was would have been correct.
Those could have been the other funny thing is it's very hard, very typical of older art to exaggerate things. The cave painting, the most famous cave painting of an auroch, is to make the animal 18 feet long. Well, the fossil record doesn't support that. So there is an artistic license, I guess you could say, to exaggerate things. Some of the animals on the cave walls are smaller than life size, of course, but the auroch, curiously, is the one that is the most exaggerated of all of the rhinoceroses or horses or whatever. So it had some kind of spell over these people, I think. You know, it was something a little magical about the beast to be the one animal to be essentially doubled in size on the cave painting. So It's all speculation, but it's fun.
You, in the book, you write that perhaps one indication of how much human beings have treasured cattle is the enormous variety of breeds, and that you see them in all kinds of shapes, sizes, and colors, and so forth. Maybe we could talk a little bit more about the history of the Angus, and that it is indeed. It does indeed come from Scotland, as the name would suggest.
Right.
You can make all the jokes you want about Scottish cooking. As far as the raw materials are concerned, the Scots know what they're doing, no matter whether you're talking about seafood or whether you're talking about steak.
Right.
They definitely know what they're doing. How did this breed come about?
Well, again, historically, and I'm not sure if everybody recalls exactly what that little silhouette in the supermarket looks like, but the distinguishing feature of the Angus, as we know it, is that it is solid black, and it's always been hornless. That is, what we call an Angus and what they called a whatever has always been a polled or hornless animal, as far as humans can remember. It's true, for instance, like take dairy cows, the three minor breeds of dairy cows, Jersey, Guernsey, Alderney, are three islands in the channel between France and England. And on those islands, farmers found an animal that they like and kept breeding towards it. Same thing happened in Scotland. People were taken in by these hornless, large, edible animals. And in various districts, perpetuated them. And human beings far before recorded time have obviously had a sort of an aesthetic as well as a practical side to their animal husbandry. And that they like the look of an animal, they will create it and then protect it by selecting out the animals that don't fit. So you do get these very distinct brown Swiss milk cattle. I mean, Charolais from France, a very distinctive kind of blonde cow. And it doesn't have to be blonde, but they liked blonde in Charolais. So And the Scots took to this black animal, although originally it could have quite a bit of white on it, particularly on the underbelly. Red is just a natural variation that occurs in the gene pool, and some people become so fond of the red Angus that that's now a separate breed. So it's this combination of the animal's practicality and its and its looks. People obviously concentrate a little bit on the aesthetics. By the way, the factory farming question, which I passed off. The other thing about the Angus in Scotland that made it a favorite was that it did put up with confinement in the winter. Hmm. And Scottish winters are miserable. So they were a cow or a bull or a calf that would put up with being actually tied in the stall for 6 months of the year, and more like a dairy cow is treated. So that's the other thing. Their short, shiny coat, by the way, is a very important part of their economic value. In Scotland originally, it meant that they would not get terribly dirty while confined, and if they did get dirty, they could be cleaned up. And in this country, they're made them almost all of beef cattle for exactly the reason I just said are very short, slick-haired, like the Herefords and so forth, because they're going to go into a feedlot situation, and long, curly hair is just more trouble in a feedlot. There's a Galloway cow from Scotland. It's also polled. It's also Scottish. It's delicious, but it has curly, kind of caracal sheep-type hair, and it has to be kept outdoors year-round. It's from a part of Scotland in the southwest where it is warm enough that the cow could be kept outdoors year-round. Hmm.
Is there something, you know, people, there are lots of people around the world, different places that raise cattle. Mm-hmm. Is there something in particular about the cattle raising practices that people there were doing in Scotland and then also that they then brought to the United States that somehow set those cattle men apart from other people who kept cattle other places in the world?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look at all the different ways that cattle are and still were and still are raised nomadically, with the some African tribes who, you know, just walked them from water to water and moved with them. And there are large areas of the world where cattle are essentially turned out on their own and only rounded up to be branded and so forth. That was the situation and still is in parts of Mexico. But it was the situation in Mexico and therefore in Texas, where it's funny that even the language says it. They used to talk about cow hunting in Texas, not cow raising, and it was really that's what it was. There were these essentially wild longhorns, and people went out, laid clay to them, branded them, and go out brand the calf to match the mother, and that was about the extent of the animal husbandry. Because of the conditions in Europe, Northern Europe, and think of Celts, including, of course, the French, as well as the Scots and the Irish and the Welsh, with a rougher climate, it became necessary to think about a kind of mini-nomad situation. You had a fixed settlement. You had fairly limited space to grow crops, including hay. And you couldn't keep cattle in a small farm year-round. You had to get them away so that you could, in a small farm, so that you could either grow hay to put up for the winter before they ate it all up, or grow crops. And so a system developed of, and is very prevalent in Wales and in Scotland, of taking the cows up to elevation, let's say above 2,000 feet in the mountains of northern England and northern Britain, and keeping them up there separately, and then bringing them back down in the fall, and then keeping them over the winter indoors and feeding them, you know, individually. And that's the exact opposite of the Texas pattern. And when the Texans tried to move their style of ranching, they were inordinately successful for about 2 years up in Montana. And then they had a series of blizzards, and essentially what closed the wide-open range wasn't men and fences. It was blizzards. It was just economically impossible to grow cattle that way or anywhere north of Texas. And so the Scotch-Irish coming out of, in, among other places, Illinois and Missouri, moved into Montana, and same thing happened in Canada. People moving east from Ontario province, they brought this idea of summer range surrounding, either horizontally or vertically separated from the farming area, and the animals being tended away from the home farm and then brought back. So it's a which meant that when things got bad in Montana in the 1880s, there were already European-style or Celtic-style ranchers out there the same time as the cattle drives in Texas were occurring. And it became clear in about 5 years who was going to win that that economic contest. And it was the rancher with fences and posts and irrigation and, you know, hay-cutting machinery. So The Scots not only got us the cattle, in a sense, but they also got us a successful way of dealing with the climate like you find in the West.
There's so many other things that I'd like to ask you, and we're here, we're coming down to the point where we're almost out of time.
Oh.
One of the things, obviously, that's helped the Angus succeed, as you say, is adaptability.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just – one thing maybe you might talk a little bit about how competitions, how raising animals for show has influenced people's ideas about just what is a beautiful animal and how that also really helped to establish the dominance of this breed.
Well, one of the things that happened with scientific agriculture was the rise of these national and local fairs to reward people for their scientific progress, as it were. I mean, state fairs were not just about not about cows and chickens. They were about great cows and great chickens, and you know, that was when agriculture was an important part of the economy. These were like prizes for building machinery, in effect. Now, one of the things that sort of helped the Angus through the years was that. The Scots never really got into the fat stock show kind of mentality. I don't know if you still have fat stock shows in Illinois, but they still have them in Texas, and which were really grossly overweight animals are brought in, and the claim is made that these hugely fat animals just prove how wonderful the breed is. Look how big he grew. Well, the Angus guys basically stayed away from that, and. So they stayed with an animal that was of a normal size and fattened normally and so forth. And when the craze for these overfat animals, and it was particularly true with Herefords and Shorthorns, all of a sudden the Angus started winning major competitions because they weren't grotesque animals. And so that didn't hurt their reputation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'll tell you what, we're going to have to finish, and I wish we could keep going.
Oh, yeah.
And for people who are interested in reading, there's much, much more in the book.
Yeah.
So they can go to it. And again, the title of the book is A Cow's Life, The Surprising History of Cattle and right. How the Black Angus Came to Be Home on the Range by our guest M.R. Montgomery. He's authored several books, including this one, and he's a former writer for the Boston Globe. Mr. Montgomery, thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. And may I make a quick plug for National Public Radio and local public radio
as
well?
Please do.
We listen to it morning, noon, and night here at this household, and we support our we have two public radio stations, one university affiliate, one independent, and we support them both, and I just encourage your listeners to do so.
Well, thank you very much.
You're
we appreciate
welcome.
That.
Okay.
And now is the time for people to do that. And we have a couple of minutes here before the afternoon magazine gets going. I'll give you the number that you can call to make a pledge. And M.R. Montgomery says so, so do it. It's 244-9455. 217 is the area code. We will go now to that place where the volunteers are waiting. They're standing by. Their hands are posed over the phone. And also standing by is Tom Rogers. He's the AM 580 News Director.
And I think a couple of those arms are cramping up. I think we haven't had too many calls yet. But they're coming in now. They're coming in now, and I'm sure that M.R. Montgomery's endorsement is helping them out. We hope to hear from you at 217-244-9455, especially if you have not called before and you've been listening to Focus 580 and Afternoon Magazine and thinking, you know, maybe I ought to become a contributor to AM 580 and help support the programming you just heard over the last couple of hours, some very thought-provoking programs. Do it now, and not only can you get that satisfaction of being a new friend to WILL, but we are on this Wednesday giving away a $10 gift certificate for each new pledge to World Harvest Food. So if you haven't done it before, call us up at 244-9455. Become a member, become a friend of WILL, become one of those elusive one out of every 10 people who listen to the station who actually pledge their financial support. And we'll throw in as our token of thanks and World Harvest's token of thanks a $10 gift certificate to their store in Champaign. And we appreciate their help and their support. We've had 95 people call up and become new friends at WILL so far this week. We want to hear from at least 300 by the time the week is out, so please do that and join people like Marta Janish of St. Joe, people who have donated even at the $40 basic membership level. We even have an offer where a very generous contributor, Bert Gray, says for every $40 pledge that comes in from a new friend at WILL, that's the basic pledge, he'll pay for half of it. You can put, you can contribute $40 and your net outlay will be $20 because he'll supply the other 20. So
that's great.
What better time to do it than now?
All right.
217-244-9455.
Thank you, Tom. We also want to thank these folks for their support. Bodywork Associates, this year they're celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Also, support comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine in Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings held every Friday from 6 to 8, that's in the evening, and Saturday afternoon 2 to 6. Information available 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com. That's it for us. Next, it's the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we're going to talk with a great friend of public broadcasting and a great guy when it comes to telling us about how to travel well and how to have a great time in Europe, traveling through the back door, getting off the beaten path and making new friends. Rick Steves will be our guest this afternoon at 106 Central Time. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade. March wheat, 291, down 3/4. May, 298 and a half, down 2. March corn, 195, up 1/4. May, 202 and 3/4, unchanged.